back in the time in the 90s, there was a great Buddhist master who's now deceased. His name was Geshe Sopa, and lived in Madison, Wisconsin. And he said one time that the way to get students interested in Buddhism is to tell them that it's the answer to all of their dreams. And I guess it depends about what you dream about, but assuming that everybody wants and certainly needs lasting, you know, unshakable joy, happiness, peace, tranquility. I mean, who wouldn't want that? And so I think that's what he meant by the dreams. And then we all have our own version of what we individually want for ourselves, family, and so forth. But it all starts with the mind. Whatever we want, we have to think about it. And then we have to create the causes for it. And if what we want is something that's virtuous and beneficial, then there are many paths, but one path that we've all chosen to investigate and put some energy in is the path of the Buddha Dharma, based on having some faith, some confidence that this path can really deliver on the claims that yes, life is problematic, that these problems have causes, these causes can be eliminated, and in doing so we can find lasting peace and happiness. That's the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha first taught. And so we, you know, it's up to us, as Lama Yeshe also used to say, it's up to us to prove that the Dharma is right. Not to prove that it's wrong. That's not a very open. The scientific method is you have an hypothesis, and then you go out and try to find evidence. And if you find no evidence, then your hypothesis was wrong. And if you find supportive evidence, then it was right. And so we look into our lives and our experiences once we have learned and practiced the Dharma and see if it really does deliver on methods to tame the mind, to eliminate our faults and develop our qualities. And it's, you know, one of the, you know, most powerful methods of doing that is to develop the mind. We need a ton of virtuous energy, positive energy, to be able to transform our mind. It's not just enough to have an intellectual understanding. We have to have a huge force of positive potential, or what we call merit, behind these understandings to transform our mind permanently and in a really deep, meaningful way. And the best way to create this merit is through not only hearing the teachings on bodhicitta or the awakening mind, but actually to meditate on them, talk about them, think about them, and then gradually, as much as we can, put them into transform our lives into the meaning of these words. And Lamayeshi's simple way of saying this was, as much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. As much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. You know, we may not get enlightened in this lifetime. It's long, it's an arduous journey. But as much as we can dedicate our life to others. And so therefore we have committed to being here tonight, and we'll meditate on each of these 11 points briefly. So maybe spend some more time on some than others until we have gone over all the key points in cultivating bodhicitta. So we can ask, you know, for the blessings of the enlightened beings. This may sound a little strange to you, but we can ask for the blessings of the enlightened beings, that our mind can be blessed, that we can deepen our understanding and experience of bodhicitta, so that it will make a difference, have an impact on our lives immediately. Here we can relax your concentration. Let's see. How far did you get in the prayers? Did she do them all? Okay. Well, let's do the three principles. I know it's in here. So one of the things about this prayer that's interesting, you know, they almost all prayers start out with homage to the gurus, right? The teachers being the main way we hear the Dharma is through the teachings. And it's not, interestingly, it's not enough to just read the words. It's important that we hear the teachings from our realized master. So it's because then I think personally it gives me confidence that the words, when I hear the teachings from the Dalai Lama, for example, I'm much more focused than when I hear them from myself, you know, from listening to whatever. It's very important. And then, so the first little bit is just setting things up, and then talking about the purpose or the benefits of generating renunciation. Then it goes on the next page is how to generate renunciation. And it's pretty clear. I mean, there's like, you know, basically we recall the freedoms and endowments, and life is short. You know, we're going to die soon, so let's turn our mind away from the things of this life. And then we think of karma and how miserable cyclic existence is. And that helps us turn our mind away from future lives, because the future is going to look just like now, because we haven't created the virtue for it to look any different. So then it's talking about okay, we've meditated on those points. Now the definition of having generated renunciation is stanza 5. And then the purpose of generating bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. And then, you know, very quick summary of how to do that. And then how do you know you've generated bodhicitta? So that's really nice. All set up there. The benefits, how to do it, and then what it's like when you've done that. Then the reason to meditate on emptiness, the stanza 9, and then how to do it, and then go to then stanza 14, kind of summarizes it. The part on emptiness is really cryptic, and you know it's. Have you had the class on emptiness yet?
The next one.
Oh, the next one. Okay, well then it'll, Robbie will be covering. No, who's doing that?
Emmett's doing it.
Oh, Emmett. Oh, great. So Emmett's going to cover it. Yeah. And so, and the point, and one of the points that I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Whenever there's a guy named Jeffrey Hopkins, who maybe some people who read Buddhist texts have heard his name, but he came here. I met him many years ago, like in the late 1970s, early 80s, and he used to say that you should always end every teaching on the. No matter what the subject is, you should always end on the note of compassion. Somehow you have to be able to tie it back into compassion. If you don't do that, you've missed the point, because all the Buddhist teachings are really to help us deepen our compassion and wisdom. Sometimes it's not so obvious, the wisdom part, but compassion, everything should be able to tie it back into that. So let's read this together, again, with some mindfulness of while we're reading it. Again, the main, you can see bodhicitta is the second of the three principal aspects. So it's not enough, can't get enlightened with bodhicitta, got to have wisdom, but the bodhicitta is the great compassion wing of the bird of enlightenment. Then you add wisdom and you got both wings. So we'll read this together. I bow down to my perfect gurus, the essential meaning of the victorious one's teachings,
the path praised by all the Buddha's names of children, the gateway of the fortunate one's desiring liberation. This I shall try to explain as much as I can. Those who are not attached to the pleasures of circling samsara, who strive to make freedom and endowments meaningful, who entrust themselves to the path pleasing the victorious ones. You fortunate ones, listen to the call of the mind with the complete intention definitely to be free from circling. There is no way to pass by attachments to seek the pleasurable acts of devotion and circling. And by understanding the cyclic existence, embodied beings are continuously bound. Therefore, at the very beginning, seek renunciation. Freedom and endowments are difficult to find. Life has no time to spare. By gaining familiarity with this, attraction to the appearances of this life is reversed. By thinking over and over again, that action and their effects are undetermined, and we repeatedly contemplate the illusions of cyclic existence, attraction to the appearances of future lives is reversed. When are you trained in that way, there's no arising, even for a second, of attraction to the perfections of cyclic existence, and all day and night the intention seeking liberation arises, then the thought of renunciation has been generated. Even if renunciation has been developed, it is not possessed by the mind of enlightenment, it has not become the cause of perfect bliss of its past enlightenment. Therefore the wise generate the supreme mind of enlightenment. Swept away by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the tight bonds of karma so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping, completely enveloped by the total darkness of ignorance, endlessly reborn in cyclic existence, ceaselessly tormented by the three sufferings, thinking that all others are in such a condition, generate the supreme mind of enlightenment.
It's like the mother who cherished son has fallen into a pit of fire,
and who experiences even 1 second of his suffering as an unbearable eternity. The reflection on the suffering of all mother sentient beings has made it impossible for you to bear their suffering for you. And the wish seeking enlightenment for their sake arises without effort. Then when we realize the supreme precious mind of enlightenment. Without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, even though you generated renunciation and the mind of enlightenment, you cannot cut the root cause of suffering. Therefore, attempt the method to realize dependent enlightenment. One sees the cause and effect of all phenomena above cyclic existence and state beyond sorrow, forever unbetrayed, and for whom any object trusted in by the grasping mind has completely disappeared, has at that time entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. If the appearance of dependent relation, which is unbetrayed, is accepted separately from emptiness, and as long as they are seen as separate, then one has still not realized the Buddha's intent. If these two realizations are happening simultaneously, without alternation, and for merely seeing dependent relation is completely unbetrayed, the definite ascertainment comes that completely destroys the way all objects were apprehended as truly existent. At that time, the analysis of the ultimate view is complete. Furthermore, appearance eliminates the extreme of existence, and emptiness eliminates the extreme of non-existence. If you realize how emptiness manifests in the manner of cause and effect, then you are not captivated by wrong notions holding extreme views. In this way, you realize exactly the vital points of the three principal aspects of the path. Resort to seeking solitude, generate the power of effort, and quickly accomplish your final goal, my child.
So, the plan tonight is to go over these 11 meditations. And I mean, does people have that handout handy? You know, I know it was given out in the first class. It's okay if you don't. I'll write them on the board as we do them. So I think, you know, we're looking at the time. Did we see, Aaron, did we say we would be finished by 9 o'clock? Okay, so we've got 2 hours. How many people can sit still for 2 hours? I'm teasing. Yeah, we started. I'm not expecting anybody to sit still. I think I don't have this thing broken down into minutes and seconds, but I know some of the points take more time than others. For example, things like equanimity, we need to spend more time on. And then, you know, some of the things like in exchanging self for others, take more time. Tong Lin will take more time and so forth. So we'll allocate the time according to it. But these, we won't cut short anything. So we talked last time about how, you know, a particular feature of the Galupa tradition is that, you know, there are two different sets of teachings to develop bodhicitta. There was this, the six cause and one effect, or sometimes called seven cause and effect. And then, so that one came down through the lineage of primarily Atisha. That was the main thing he taught in Tibet. And then, but he also, he taught this exchanging self with others to some few disciples, but not generally speaking. And then the lineage of exchanging self for others comes to Shantideva, you know, who wrote the Bodhicharavatara. And so that's a little bit different method of developing bodhicitta. It's said that the seven cause and effect generates more kind of, because you're thinking about your mother and how kind she was and how everybody, you know, it's supposed to be more like heartwarming, a little bit, but very hard to use that method to develop bodhicitta. But then we say that the exchanging self for others is also like the most powerful way to develop loving kindness. And in some ways you gotta have that to have compassion. So it's important. And so here we've taken both of these methods and combined them into one. And that's something that apparently only the Galupa tradition has done. And one of the special features of the tradition. So, there's several different versions of this, outline. The one I'm going to use is one I learned from Geshe Rabtan a long time ago, but this basically goes back to the one that Prabhankar Rinpoche, who wrote Liberation in the Palm of Your Hands, he was really good at teaching bodhicitta and this outline. So the first point, and I won't be able to write it up here, but I can talk about it. We have a handout, so that's good. The first point is... Well, I have a pen here. I'll just write on it. No, I'm teasing. It's okay. It's not crucial. Well, so it might be nice to look up and see. But we've got it right here. So this is as good as it gets. All right. See, this is even the outline that I particularly would have given, but it is what it is. There's equanimity, and then knowing all living beings as our mother, remembering the past and present kindness of all mother beings, developing the wish to repay the kindness of all mother beings, equalizing self and others, contemplating from many angles the dangers of self-cherishing, contemplating the many angles, the advantages of cherishing others. Thank you. Then the actual practice of exchanging the attitude of self-cherishing for the attitude of cherishing others. And then Tong Lin is actually 9 and 10 together. Focusing on taking, practice of taking, focusing on compassion, the practice of giving, focusing on love. So that's Tong Lin. And then developing the superior intention. Remember, that's, you know, this is the big one to bite off. I am personally responsible for the happiness of all sentient beings. It's my job. And it's a great attitude. It's a heroic attitude. And because it's motivated by love and compassion, it's not like, you know, like a megalomaniac or, you know, it's a, anyway, it's a Robert Thurman calls it a messianic vow. I don't really like that kind of language, but it's a vow that you're gonna be the one who's gonna guide others, infinite other beings, no matter how long it takes. You're never gonna give up on anybody, including yourself. And then developing bodhicitta, again, bodhi means mind, citta means awakening. No, other way around. Bodhi means awakening, citta means mind, so the awakening mind. And, you can say it so many ways, like Jeffrey Hopkins calls it the altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. Kind of long-winded. It's an intention, so it's an altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. And, one thing I asked Jeffrey Hopkins one time, I said, we're talking about bodhicitta, and he was saying that, and I alluded to this earlier, that to realize emptiness, which is quite, just to understand it intellectually takes, some effort, and really working with the meaning of the words and focusing on it and trying to train yourself every day to understand it, but to really have it be part of your experience, so-called realization of emptiness, you have to have an incredible amount of merit. And he said, bodhicitta is the reason you can realize emptiness. That's what it takes. Intellectually, there are a lot of people that understand emptiness, but they're not very, very, very few that have the realization of emptiness. That is, that's how they see the world. And so we need bodhicitta to help this great compassion that bodhicitta is about. We need that to empower the wisdom consciousness. And then the wisdom consciousness empowers the compassionate consciousness. Remember how we talked about that? About how wisdom, if wisdom was just dry like saltines, didn't have any moisture, it wouldn't really move, really wouldn't appeal to us. It wouldn't change our mind. But we need the moisture of compassion to empower the wisdom consciousness. And then the wisdom consciousness likewise empowers compassion consciousness. All right, so here we are. The 12 steps. We'll start out with equanimity. And I actually used to have a meditation timer here, but I'll just try to pay attention to it. We'll spend maybe the next 20 minutes. Because this is, I think, if not the most important meditation in the whole bodhicitta generation, it's one of them. And because it is the foundation. So if you want to stretch your legs, stand up, do something and wake your body up and then have a seat back down. Again, if you're sitting in a chair, yeah, that's fine. If you're sitting in a chair, you want to sit up as straight as you can. And we'll start out by focusing on the breath. And we can do something a little different. We haven't done this before. But before each meditation, this is a thousand-arm chinrezig. I don't know if there's a four-arm chinrezig here, is there? There might be one in this tanka on the 35 Buddhas. Nope, not one there.
That's not the one on the right now.
No. But, yeah. So thousand-arm chinrezig. And, you know, the Dalai Lama is said to be the embodiment of the of chinrezig. Chinrezig is the Buddha of compassion. And you can think of these different Buddha figures as...
Sure, because I saw this in the NC State Fair, and I thought I took a picture of him.
What, of the form? Or?
Yeah, the form.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, there's a forearm chinrezig that, you know, the two hands at the heart, and then one holds a flower, and another one holds a rosary. So the forearm chinrezig, and then there's the thousand arm chinrezig with lots of heads, and a thousand arms with little eyes on the palm of each hand, and it's reaching out, you know, to help all sentient beings who are suffering. So you don't have to have that, you know, specific visualization, but before every meditation, what I'm going to do is I'm going to suggest that you imagine about a body's length in front of you, and as big as you can, this orb of light that, you know, as best you can imagine that it's chinrezig. Okay? And thousand arms reaching out. The Buddha's, all of the Buddha's compassion is symbolized by chinrezig. And you want to think that chinrezig is not just a static image or like a hologram, but it's like a living presence of the Buddha's compassion. And then we'll say the mantra about 21 times. We'll say it together. It doesn't take long. I'm going to say it. Some people have never heard it before, so I'm going to tell you right now how to say it. But it's probably the most common mantra recited in all of Tibetan Buddhism. So it's like, Om. Just repeat after me. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. And it's translated a lot of different ways. Hail to the jewel and the lotus, but don't worry about what the, you know, it's the intent of this mantra is to cultivate compassion. Okay? So as we say the mantra, we'll imagine that blessings come from the chinrezig. That's, again, a body length in front and at the level of our forehead, you know, seated on this lotus and sun and embodying all the Buddha's compassion. And as we say the mantra, imagine that the blessings of compassion are entering the crown of our head and completely filling our body. As we say it just these 21 times. I'll keep up. I'll count them. So again, bring this, imagine this living presence of the Buddha's compassion that we'll label chinrezig as a unusual appearance, but it's all symbolic of being able to reach out to beings in all 10 directions and helping alleviate their suffering. And so we want that living presence. That living presence will send light and nectar into the crown of our head and fill us with our body and mind with the energy, the blessings of compassion. As we say this, if you feel comfortable saying it, don't have to, but we'll say it 21 times. Now the different, I think we'll, you know, we could chant it, but I think we'll just I mean, we can sing it, but I think we'll just chant it. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. And imagine that your body, speech, and mind have been blessed by this energy of compassion of Chenrezig. And we're going to meditate now on equanimity, developing this equal regard for the different kinds of beings. And we'll put everybody in three different categories. We'll start out with friends, then strangers, and then people that we will label enemy, but, you know, someone we feel aversion toward. People we're attached to, people we feel indifferent toward, and people we feel aversion toward. Those are the three kinds of beings that we're going to bring to mind. And you want to try to bring to mind, like, for example, for attachment, bring to mind somebody that you really are attached to, and let the mind of attachment arise. You want it to, even though it's a negative mind in some sense, we're using this meditation to help us experience it and to begin to work with the energy and the misunderstandings that lead to that. So who are you most attached to right now? And then we can use several lines of reasoning to lessen the grip of attachment, understanding the evolution of attachment. It comes about when the mind perceives somebody as being inherently desirable or pleasant. You know, somebody that we call a friend. Somebody, it could be a child, it could be one of our family members, but somebody that we think is inherently, good for us, kind to us, brings us joy, brings us happiness. And we don't understand that our mind is projecting this. We think that those qualities exist out there, existing from the side of that person. That person really has those qualities. We don't take any responsibility for the fact that we're the ones that are projecting those good qualities on them. They're just, what they do is barely neutral, but we see goodness coming from their side. And because we exaggerate their good qualities, we get drawn into attachment. When in fact, not only do people's behaviors change from moment to moment and day to day and lifetime to lifetime, but even the friend is, that label could change. That person that we call our friend could become our worst enemy. And it's happened many times, probably to many of us in this lifetime. people that we liked or loved, now we can barely stand the sight of them. It's not permanent. And in past lifetimes, if we're going to play the lifetime, past lifetime game, as Jeffrey uses it, talks about it, we can see that in past lifetimes, yes, they were my mother. Yes, they were very kind to me. But also in past lifetimes, they've been like, they've like slaughtered us and been extremely mean. And it's, you know, the relationship has been very up and down from lifetime to lifetime. And so we look at this friend who is the friend of our worst enemy, our ego, you know, who basically tells us what we want to hear. Barely, rarely will a friend be brutally honest with us, although some of us have friends like that. Most of us, we think of our friends as being kind to us most of the time. You know, but the so-called friend is the friend of our worst enemy, our self-cherishing, egocentric self. And again, the relationship definitely is impermanent, will not last forever. You know, we put so much energy and hope in these friends. You know, parents who put all their lives, their whole lives' efforts into raising their children, and then when they grow up, they won't even talk to them. I mean, you know, I personally know several people like that. It's like, just terrible, you know, very painful. So we try to lessen the clinging attachment toward the so-called friend, seeing them as labeled by the mind, impermanent, in past lifetimes have been not so kind to us. This lifetime they are kind, so they get the label friend, but it's not permanent. So we get a sort of lessen the attachment and develop a more equanimous attitude toward the friend. Then the next being is the stranger. And strangers are like, you know, just like anybody. Like most of us in this room probably don't know each other very well, would consider it, you know, we're sort of strangers to one another because we haven't spent a lot of time together. But there are plenty of people that we pass on the road, in the elevators, and in the malls and streets and so forth that are definitely strangers. And we are completely indifferent toward these beings. We don't feel one way or the other. We just have, you know, we I don't want to say we don't care, but you know, for the most part, we're more focused on ourselves than them. And yet, a few kind words and the so-called stranger, the person we label stranger, can become a friend. And of course, the opposite, a few unkind words, mistaken kind of speaking or acting, can cause the stranger to become an enemy. Someone that feels aversion toward us, and likewise we feel the same way. So again, this stranger has been our mother in the past lifetime, has also been mean, you know, has done all manner of evil toward us, directed toward us. because we have this potential to have had countless previous lifetimes, and in every lifetime we've had strangers and friends and family, and this person has been in every potential relationship with us. We don't remember that. And they want to be happy, just like we do. They're just like we are. We walk right by them without any recognition, literally, that they exist. And we label them unconsciously stranger, and we just keep right on walking. We have no regard for these beings, one way or the other. And so we want to let go of this indifference that we feel toward the stranger. Which makes up the vast majority of beings on this in the universe, but on this planet. You imagine you're a stranger and you try to get some sense of the potential of this being. But also, you know, equal regard for the friend and the stranger. And then we imagine, and this is the most, I think maybe the most important of the three meditations, is to bring to mind visualize somebody in front of you that you really genuinely do not like to be around, would prefer avoiding their company. And allow a mind of aversion to arise. You might even think of the reasons that you dislike them. And then to benefit our mind, disliking this person and the aversion that we feel it is a negative mind state. It's poisoning us. And, it's sort of like anger. Anger's like drinking poison, expecting somebody else to die, the person that we dislike. It's stupid. And yet somehow we feel justified in being angry. It's not helpful. Not helpful for the mind. Paralyzes the best part of our mind, which is wisdom and compassion. They cannot function in the same moment. So this so-called enemy, we look at, again, using these two obvious reasonings. One is the impermanent nature of the enemy. Of course, all of our enemies eventually will die, but I'm talking now about things like the enemy has not, and that relationship is changeable. Could become a stranger. We may never see him again, but the so-called enemy could become a friend. Just a few, a sincere apology and a few kind words could transform a person that we now have a lot of problem with, into at least someone that we can tolerate, if not the potential for a sincere friendship. So this, it's not fixed, and yet our mind clings to the notion that the enemy exists inherently out there, hardwired, objectively out there, and we exaggerate their negative qualities. We don't want to see anything positive about them, and we don't. And when we think about it, that projection of enemy that we cling to and feel so strongly about can change at any moment. And in past lifetimes, this mean being was indeed our mother, our dear mother, or father, or best friend. They've been very kind to us. Yep, they've been mean to us too. But, you know, interestingly, the relationship that is the valid relationship, you have to think about this one now, the relationship that's the valid relationship is the one where you feel warmth and connection toward this being. Not when they harmed you, that relationship. Harming others is based on delusion. Virtuous behavior is based on wisdom. And it's kind of like if your mother was sick and was given, you know, some narcotics or something, and grabbed a knife out of the kitchen and was coming at you to stab you. Like what you would do would be to take the knife out of her hand and try to subdue her as gently as you could. You wouldn't like get into a fight with her and then stab her with it. You know, you would understand that the reason she's treating you that way is because she's under the effect of this sickness and the medicines. And so she's reacting out of delusion. In the same way, the beings that harm us are reacting out of delusion. And the real cause, and Shanti Deva talks about this, and we use this example every time, if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get angry with the stick. That'd be stupid. You get angry at the person that's wielding the stick. And this, in the same way, this person who's harming us is like the stick. The real source of the harm that we're experiencing are actions generated by our own self-cherishing mind that set into motion this karmic wheel, this karmic boomerang that's now coming to us in the form of harmful actions. This other being is harming us. But the real demon, the real source of our suffering, is our own former actions motivated by selfishness, self-cherishing. And then this another reasoning that's very interesting and a little bit hard to hear when you first hear it is that there's no potential for enlightenment without having the perfection of patient endurance. Patience is so important. And we do not learn in patience by having an easy life. Patience is cultivated in dependence upon, and tolerance in dependence upon tough situations and tough people that aggravate us. And so we in essence need a good enemy to be able to develop true patience. The perfection of patience, which is necessary to become a Buddha, is dependent upon the enemy, the so-called person that we feel aversion toward. And so they're like our ticket out of here. so precious. So precious. And all our mind wants to do is focus on his or her negative qualities, and they're swimming in good qualities. But we don't, our mind is so deluded, we cannot see it. And so we have to really make ourselves to begin to see that this person isn't inherently bad, evil, or wrong. That this relationship is impermanent. The label is impermanent, and like I said, in past lifetimes, many different possibilities. And so we go back, and let's look at the so-called enemy, see if we can soften our attitude toward this person a little bit, seeing them as now like a teacher, and even the harm that they did to us is actually the fruition of a karmic seed. And the karmic seed's finished. So it's like helping us purify our negative karma. So kind, so helpful. And I really think that this is a meditation. If you put some time into it, you can be extremely helpful. Particularly the one, I think the one with the friend too, and the stranger, all three, but particularly this one, the person that we feel aversion toward, can be so helpful for our mind. And now try to cultivate a feeling of equanimity. All three categories of beings, so-called friends, friends that we cling to, strangers that we feel indifference toward, and so-called enemies that we feel aversion toward. How to let go of those, not necessarily the distinctions, but these mental qualities that keep us apart from these people. Because we have to get enlightened for all living beings, not just the ones we love. We're going to get enlightened for universal living beings. So this is the foundation for developing compassion and loving kindness. And the way we do these analytical meditations is, you know, you think about the friend and the stranger and the enemy, and maybe you see a little shift in your mind about the friend, maybe let go a little bit of the attachment, and we let go of this, a little bit of this indifference toward the stranger, and let go a little bit of the aversion toward the enemy. And then once we get a sense of, to the degree we can develop it, whatever we get is fine. But once you sense, you get a sense of equanimity, then you stop the analysis of friend, stranger, and enemy. And that this whatever you generated is a feeling. There's a feeling associated with that. You want to hold your mind single-pointedly on that experience, that feeling associated with that realization, whatever you have generated, and keep your mind focused one-pointedly on that experience. Now relax your concentration. If you want to stand up, I think we'll just take a couple of minutes between each meditation. So you're going to stretch, bathroom break, whatever. Now's a good time to do that.
Said,
hello. Yeah.
That when we see some negative person or negative aspect, that we are selfish. But recently experienced so much anger because I felt this person, my close friend, keeps asking. I felt like it was asking me to cross my ethics. You know, I grew up doing yoga and under my father, very strict ethical point. So I felt this person was asking me to bend me into other aspect just to promote them. And actually it just made me angry for 2 days. Couldn't even function. And then I just had to go out of town to just do something else to calm myself. And then each time this person asks me again and again, I keep guiding them to, instead of being angry, I kept guiding them to go to bigger organizations so that they will understand the ethics of it than me continuously repeating the same thing. That I don't want to be part of this.
Right.
Maybe they don't see it, but for me it was... So I don't know how I am selfish in that. I couldn't figure out when you're saying I brought this person into my presence and I couldn't understand how I'm being selfish in that. So that was
well, it's a good question. It's a fair question, and it's one of those things that have you been here for the karma, the module on karma? Okay. So we understand that karmic seeds are constantly ripening. Most of the things that are ripening right now, today, tonight, in this lifetime, were seeds planted in former lifetimes. Right? It's not just what we did yesterday ripening today. You know, the vast majority of the karmic seeds, I'd almost say all, but I don't want to, you never say all, but almost everything we experience now is the product of all of our former moments of consciousness going back from beginning of time. And so, you know, you might not be able to see what you did. It's not like you deserved it or you did anything to deserve that. But, it, you know, from a karmic perspective, it's helpful for our minds to see that we're accountable for our experience 100%, right? It's never helpful to see yourself as a victim. Never helpful. Even though we use the word victim, if somebody came in here and shot us all, you know, the newspaper would say, ever how many people are here? 20 victims. And they would be right. That's, you know, we didn't obviously do anything to deserve it. But from a Buddhist perspective, we all had done, we probably had shot this person. Well, karmically speaking, we'd all killed him or her in a former lifetime. And now we're getting the karmic fruit of that. The point is that karma is very complex. It's not easy to figure out. And it's helpful for the mind to take responsibility for everything, the good and the bad, right? And when things happen to us, it's not like we're a bad person. It's just the fruit of past former actions ripening now. We're getting harmed now. I remember this lady. I was listening to NPR, and this lady from Thailand. This is back in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and she was a very strong Buddhist practitioner, and at least she had a strong belief in karma. And so when she got AIDS from her husband, who'd got it from a prostitute, her attitude was like nobody could, at least the people on NPR couldn't believe it. You know, this lady, aren't you angry at him? No, this is my karma. You know, this is my past actions coming back to me. It doesn't help me to get angry. You know, now I'm sure she confronted him, and there were some things to be said, but from her perspective, you know, she was seeing it as her own former actions coming back to her from past lifetimes. And, yeah, she was purifying negative karma. So, I don't know if this is getting at what you were talking about, but it's what goes around comes around. It's a point of view. It's the Buddhist point of view. There are no accidents. You might not agree with that, but you might want to take a look at it and see how it affects your mind. You know, you wouldn't go around and tell somebody, well, you got what you deserve because you did something bad in the past. They wouldn't get it. It wouldn't help, right? But from our perspective, looking at everything that's coming up moment to moment as the ripening of our own former actions, you know, helps us from getting tied into, you know, pointing fingers at people and turning, you know, people that are harming us into, you know, enemies necessarily, when we can see that it's the fruit of our own former actions. They're just the vehicle by which the negativity is coming back to me. The real demon, the real problem was my self-cherishing mind, right? According to this meditation on the faults of self-cherishing, which we'll get to in a minute.
Why do they not remember anything at all of our past? Would that like be helpful or what? I mean, nothing.
Some people do. That
yeah.
We cannot recall anything of any of our past lives, and we've probably had so many.
Well, you know, some people do. Some people, you know, some children particularly sometimes will make some, will have memories of past lifetimes, but if they say anything to their parents about it, they can't, because the parents don't necessarily have that worldview, they wouldn't respond to it. But I don't want to get off on that subject.
Close.
I'd rather stay with Bodhicitta here for, yeah. All right, so let's, again, we'll sit up straight and get our mind focused of focusing on the breath, and then we'll bring Buddy the Buddha Chinrezig, but start out just by following the breath for just a moment. again, imagine at the level of the forehead and a body length in front of you is this, it looks like, you know, Chinrezig. You could imagine Chinrezig, the Buddha of compassion, is like a hologram, but you don't want to think of it as just a static image, but it's like a, think of it as a living presence of the, all the compassion of the Buddha and the form. And we're giving it a form, and its color is completely white and pure, the form of Chinrezig, but this Buddha of compassion. I want to do the mantra again 21 times. As we say it, we could imagine that light and nectar coming from Chinrezig heart is entering the crown of our head, completely purifying our body, speech, and mind, and granting us the blessings of the meditations on, to develop bodhicitta. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum. Pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum, om mani pime hum. I now feel that we've been blessed by the Chinrezig's compassion energy to be able to meditate on seeing all beings as our mother, remembering the kindness of all mother sentient beings, and then developing the wish to repay that kindness. And so the first contemplative or analytical meditation is to, again, it depends. All of these seven cause and effect meditations depend on having some, at least openness about the possibility of past lifetimes and the fact that the mind is beginningless, which is logical. Time is beginningless. Consciousness, from the Buddhist perspective, has no beginning. And the first moment of consciousness of this life, which is formless, consciousness is not substance like sperm and egg and the body, but it's formless. The first formless moment of consciousness of this life had to come from a former moment of consciousness, which is also formless, which came from a past lifetime. And so that moment of consciousness was preceded by a former moment of consciousness, so the consciousness of the past life, and then the life before that, and the life before that, and going on and on and on, back endlessly to the beginning of beginningless time. So that's the notion of beginningless mind that we are playing with when we think about rebirth, reincarnation, and when we start talking about our mother of this life having been our mother in countless past lifetimes, and will again be our mother in future lifetimes. And we will be her mother in future lifetimes. And we've been her mother in countless previous lifetimes. We particularly have a strong karmic connection with our mother of this life. Very powerful karmic object for us to, you know, negative actions directed toward our mom are very powerful, and as well as positive actions directed toward her. And when we can open up to this possibility, we can also realize that it's possible that all beings, that the other people in this room, maybe just think about your loved ones, that in past lifetimes they've been your mom and will again in the future. And then the people in this room, we've all been family in past lifetimes. We just don't remember it. Kind of like we were talking a moment ago. It'd be nice if we could remember it. But, you know, the Buddha, who was omniscient, said, I remember it. He could see all these past lifetimes. He could see that we'd been in all these different relationships. And so, in essence, all the living beings, even not just the people, but the animals, the insects, every sentient being, every being that has consciousness, has been our mother in the past and will again be our mother in the future. And of course, this relationship is chosen because, generally speaking, it's the most powerful, intimate relationship that we'll have in our whole lifetime. You know, this is somebody who literally gave us our body. So we try to see universal living beings, even insects. We think, you know, next time you see one, just think, that being has been my parent in a past lifetime. That insect has consciousness and has been like family in past lifetimes. Yeah, so Lama Yeshe used to call everybody kind mother. Kind mother. So many teachers, they use that label to remind them that all beings have been their mother and been kind to them. So if we do that meditation reasonably well, we develop whenever we see a stranger, we immediately feel some kind of connection, not just disconnect. Because part of us has the realization that all beings have been family. Then we turn our attention to the kindness of the mother and, you can just run your mind through what happened from soon after conception, and when, you know, many, many women have, you know, sickness during at least the first trimester. They have nausea and vomiting and just don't feel right, and the body's beginning to change in ways that are gradually become more and more uncomfortable. And then you have to be careful to eat the right foods and not to harm the baby. And then toward the latter part of the pregnancy, it's difficult to get comfortable, can't sleep, heartburn, maybe had some complications along the way that might even have put your mom's life at risk. And then, of course, she goes into labor, and it's like the worst pain ever, right up there with kidney stones, as people say. Very painful for most women. And of course, a lot of people go straight to the epidural, but the mothers in the good old days, they did it the hard way, and it was very painful. And as soon as we were born, going through all of that, as soon as we were born, you know, your mom was so happy, you know, the obstetrician would take the baby and put it on the mom's tummy and let the baby suckle, because that sucking on the breast, and the babies know exactly what to do because they've done it in past lifetimes and they know what to do in this lifetime. It's one of those karmic instincts. Causes the, you know, the uterus to contract. So, and the mother looks at this baby and it's like, no matter how much suffering she's had for the last 9 months, it's like, it's not even in her mind. It's just, she's so happy to see you and to see that you're healthy and you're alive and, you know, just no big deal. She's not worried about anything other than your well-being. And then you can go through, you know, the sacrifices that mothers make for their sleep. And no matter, you know, your mom is in bed with 103 fever and you're crying, boom, she's out of bed. No matter what it takes to take care of her child, she'll do it. She does whatever it takes. And then, so we try to, you know, while we're doing this, we genuinely try to think of our mother and real scenarios that probably happened, and then some things that we know happened, like when she took us to school and how sad she was. Like it was a big transition for her, and then how she taught us how to walk and talk and bought us clothes and took us to this and that, and literally early on in life we wouldn't have lasted. We wouldn't have lived a day without her kindness. And now later on when we go into college, and then once we finish, whatever we did, even we got married or didn't get married, whatever we did, wherever we went, she was always paying attention, hoping that we were okay. Never, ever. A part of her mind was always preoccupied with us and wishing us well. And so whether your mother is still alive or deceased, your mother of this life, you know, has been incredibly kind to us and kind to you. You know, in there's a sutra that's famous in Chinese Buddhism. It says, if we carried our parents on our shoulders, it's called the Filial Piety Sutra. And it says, if we carry our parents on our shoulders our entire adult life, we couldn't begin to repay their kindness for having given us the opportunity to be a human being. Think about that. That we develop a sincere wishing all kind mother sentient beings to be happy. It's just a natural evolution of that meditation, as you wish your mother happiness and all your other kind mother sentient beings happiness. And when we do this meditation well, when we see somebody walking down the street, not only do we feel connected, but we have a sense of warmth toward them. And then the next meditation or point is, you know, it just follows that this all of these kind mother sentient beings who've done so much for us, it's our responsibility to repay their kindness. You know, they've done so much to help us, you know, giving us opportunities and cherishing us, and it's our responsibility to repay the kindness of our mothers. No one else's responsibility. It's our responsibility. It's the right thing to do. Now that I'm going to shift, we're going to do one more brief meditation on the quality of self and others, and now we've sort of moving away from the seven cause and effect, even though we haven't gotten to, we've only covered part of those meditations. Now we're moving into the exchange of self for others, and the first one is seeing ourself and others as equal. And so having done these meditations that we've done up until now, make it a little easier to see ourselves and others as equal. So seeing the quality of self and others. You know, this is redundant. I mean, we said it so many times. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. You want to be happy. You don't want to suffer. The faceless strangers that we see, you know, you get right down to the bottom. Their bottom line is, I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. That's everybody's bottom line. We're all equal in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. And yet, who's the most important one? Is it me or is it you? Is it self or is it others? See, so the ego has a very, you know, a very obvious answer to that. Egocentricity says, I am the most important one. You know, the world, I am the center of this universe. My universe, I'm at the geographic center of my universe. What brings me happiness, I cling to, and what disturbs my happiness, I feel aversion toward. And it doesn't work. We all want the same thing. It puts us in the ego puts us in opposition to everyone else. Because we all are driven by self-centeredness. But in this meditation, we're trying to, you know, push our mind in the direction of seeing that we're all equally wanting happiness and equally not wanting to suffer. So the Dalai Lama, I gave this example last time. He imagined this line, and on one side is holiness, and he says, you know, I want to be happy and I don't want to suffer. And on the other side are universal living beings, maybe all in human form. And everybody over there has the same desire. I want to be happy and I don't want to suffer. Whose happiness is more important? The happiness of one or the happiness of infinite others? Logically, the happiness of infinite others. Others' happiness is more important than the happiness of one, if you just want to be completely objective about it. But that's too big a step for us right now. So at least we can acknowledge that we all equally want happiness, and in that, this way, this really, really important way, we're all the same. Something we know very, something that's very intimate, that we know about every living being, animals, humans, you name it. Every being wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. This is good to even go through your friends, your family, one at a time, and people that you may feel indifferent toward, and then the hardest people to work with are the so-called enemies, and gradually thinking about them in this way. They're just like me. They want to be happy. They don't want to suffer. To the next, we'll take any questions about that? Okay. So we'll just take another minute to chill, and then we'll do the faults of self-cherishing, the value of cherishing others, and then exchanging self for others. Okay, let's go ahead and get started so we can get through these last meditations. You can just you can use the sound of this bell, this bowl. Just if you stay focused on it, it rings for like a minute after. Just listen to the sound of it and let your mind stay focused on it, and then settle your mind on your breath at that point. Just listen to this. Again, Chinrezig is in the space in front at the level of our forehead and the body's length in front. This is the Buddha of compassion, made of completely of white light. And as we say the mantra together, this light and nectar emanates from Chinrezig's heart, entering the crown of our head, and we're completely filled with the blessings of Chinrezig's compassionate wisdom and good energy in the form of light and nectar. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Pime hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Pime hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, 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 om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum. And again, we've been blessed by the compassionate wisdom energy of the Buddha of Compassion, Shinrezig, to realize the meditations leading up to developing bodhicitta, which, you know, when we think about it, I must become enlightened in order to liberate all sentient beings. It's so antithetical to our normal way of thinking. It's the opposite of egocentricity. You know, ego would say, I want to get enlightened for me, you know, not for others. Completely opposite. So powerful, powerful antidote to our self-cherishing mind. So let's look at this. You know, leading up to this point, we've done meditations on equanimity. Then we saw that, you know, everyone has been our mother, and in this and countless previous lifetimes, and will again in the future be our mother, has been kind. Our mothers of all of our past lifetimes have been kind to us, as kind as our mother of this life. And then we develop the wish to repay that kindness. And then we meditated on the equality of self and others. How we all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. Just like we're all the same. So then the next meditations are about looking at the problems with self-cherishing and selfishness. Now we think, and I'm not speaking for everybody, but I can speak for myself, that my instinct, and I suspect most people's instinct, is that our ego is like our best friend. It protects us. It gets us what we want and need. It's not our worst enemy. And yet, these teachings are saying the source of all of our problems is this self-cherishing, selfish mind. Where did this come from? How did it come about? How long has it been around? Well, self-cherishing, selfishness has been there since the beginning, of our mind. It's always been present. It's always been present. Ignorance. This self-cherishing ignorance has always been present. But because it's based on a misapprehension, it can come to an end. It can come to an end. And so we have to examine, is selfishness really our friend? We think it is, our protector. But look at the things, if we look at the 10 non-virtuous acts, just the ones of body and speech, the ones of mind are countless, but the ones of body and speech, the biggies, killing, taking other lives, totally driven by self-cherishing selfishness, stealing, taking what doesn't belong to us, adultery or sexual misconduct, you know, it's not having regard for others. It's all about me and what I want. And then lying, deceiving others, slandering and bad-mouthing others, all of this driven by selfishness and self-cherishing, harsh speech, and idle gossip. All of these are driven by self-cherishing, selfishness. All of them set into motion the karmic boomerang that's going to come back and cause us to suffer. And then the three poisonous minds, greed, and hatred and ignorance, are all driven by self-cherishing selfishness. So according to the laws of karma, any action motivated by this negative mind of self-cherishing is going to lead to suffering eventually. Might get some temporary, you know, happiness, temporary excitement, but eventually, you know, definitely going to cause suffering. Definitely going to bring bring it back to us, things that we don't want. So we have to start seeing self-cherishing for what it is. It's like our worst enemy. The teachings say that all the suffering from the beginning of beginningless time up until now, between individuals, between, you know, communities and countries, you find the venue, but it's all brought about by self-cherishing. What I want, or you offended me, and so on. And then all happiness is brought about by cherishing others. This is like flipping the energy. The energy and self-cherishing is totally dark, constricted, narrow, all about me, me, I, you know. And then cherishing others, the energy goes out, you know, where we're focusing on others' happiness, non-harming, you know, seeing their good qualities, protecting them, being kind to them, loving them, and so on. So if we truly cherished others, we wouldn't kill them, we wouldn't steal from them, we wouldn't commit adultery, we wouldn't lie, we wouldn't slander them, we wouldn't speak harshly to them, about them, we wouldn't waste their time with idle gossip. We wouldn't hate them, you know, clinging attachment, not so likely to happen. Because cherishing others is not about attachment and ignorance. So we see, and there are countless other negative mind states that are all, you know, the antidote is cherishing others. And so, you know, Lama Zopa says, on that bumper sticker we used to sell here a long time ago, it says, for happiness, simple, cherish others. For happiness, cherish others. All the actions motivated by cherishing others will eventually ripen in happiness for us. Selfless actions done with the mind of cherishing others will ripen in happiness for us. Just because that's how the universe works. That's how the mind works. And the next meditation is to exchange self-cherishing for cherishing others. And now we're going to exchange this attitude of self-cherishing. We're not going to change places with anybody, but we're exchanging the attitude that we've had all of our lives and from beginning this lifetimes up until now, that we've become so habituated to. Now we're going to start systematically, gradually deconditioning the self-centered attitude and conditioning the attitude that cherishes others. And little ways. We set our motivation in the morning. We get up to behave in ways that cherish others. And now we're going to, instead of doing Tang Lin, we're going to just focus on the practice of taking, focusing on compassion. So what do these others that we cherish so much, that we're training our minds to cherish, what do they don't want? They don't want suffering. And we have to have, and this is why there's so much emphasis early on in Buddhism about studying the nature of suffering, that, for example, even the things that we now label as causes for happiness are, for the most part, examples of what the Buddha would call suffering of change, because they don't last. None of these things, experiences that we now crave and strive for last. And when we get them and they don't last, we're left like wanting more, never satisfied, like drinking salt water. So we're all like that. We all have common everyday sufferings, you know, sickness, aging, old age, and death is coming for all of us, some sooner than others. Problems every day, queuing up, waiting for us for tomorrow and the day after and next week and next year. You know, having to separate from people and things that we like, and having to meet difficulties again and again. Meeting leads to parting. High position leads to low position. Nothing lasts. Everything will come to an end, including us. And we all have to deal with the reality of this. You know, it's painful. Suffering is painful. Nobody wants to suffer. And so we practice mentally taking on the suffering of others. Like, how nice it would be if they could be free. You can imagine that you're surrounded by universal living beings, all in human form. You can imagine your mom on your left, your dad on your right, your male friends and family are on the right, your female friends and family on your left, and then, you know, in front of you are your people you feel aversion toward, and your the rest of them are around you. But it's your universal living beings. And you imagine, you know, may you be free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of suffering and its causes. And you can imagine, you know, even breathing in their suffering. Not only, you know, working, we talked about working with yourself. You can actually visualize your ordinary self there, and not only the suffering of this life, but in our future lifetimes. You can imagine universal living beings, and you want to take their suffering on. And so you can imagine you breathe that in the form of black smoke. You can take a couple of breaths to make that happen. And then it goes down, and that black smoke, you know, goes into your, it strikes like a, kind of like a sword at this rock at your heart, this black orb of that surrounds your heart of self-cherishing selfishness and completely destroys it. And then your body's filled with light. And then you send that light out to the beings who are suffering. And you think, may they have happiness and the causes of happiness. Actually, you could start out by saying how nice it would be if they had happiness and the causes of happiness. And then may they have happiness and the causes of happiness. And then I will give them happiness and the causes of happiness. And as you say that last one, I will give them happiness and the causes of happiness, you breathe out that white light, and that it fills your body. You breathe out that white light of loving kindness, and it completely fills the body of all of these universal living beings, including yourself and including all these friends and family and people you know and so forth, to involve universal living beings. And you imagine that they have what they want and need. They have their temporal needs met, whatever those are, and then they have their ultimate needs met. Imagine that they meet the Dharma, that they have the good karma to take an interest in it, then they have the good karma to practice it, and then meet a qualified teacher, and then to actually gain realizations on the path, all the way up to becoming a bodhisattva, and then ultimately a Buddha. Imagine that you're giving them all of that in the form of white light. We can do this maybe one or two more times. Imagine we're taking on the suffering of different beings. We can play with this. We can think about a friend who's a Buddhist monk for 20 years, he said this is like the most helpful practice for him. And then Venerable George Chernoff, who's just finishing up a 3-year retreat in the mountains of North Carolina, he said Tonglen's the most helpful practice. He's to help his mind. For example, if you're angry, you can imagine all the beings in the world that are experiencing anger right now, and that you're going to take their anger into your may they be free of anger and the causes of anger. I'm personally responsible for eliminating their anger. And you take it into your heart. And you imagine that whatever anger you're experiencing sort of suffices for them. But it, in the process, destroys your self-cherishing mind. And you breathe out. How nice it would be if they could have happiness in his causes. May they have happiness in his causes. I will give them happiness in his causes. And you breathe out the white light of loving, of loving kindness. And then they get what they want and need, which is lasting peace and happiness and ultimately full enlightenment. So we do this when we think, how nice it would be if you could be free of suffering and its causes. May you be free. You can feel the intensity gets a little stronger with each one of these phrases. How nice it would be if you could be free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of suffering and its causes. I will be the cause of you to be free of suffering and its causes. as you breathe in their suffering. And then how nice it would be if you could have happiness in its causes. May you have happiness in its causes. And I will be the cause for you to achieve happiness and to experience happiness in its causes. That's Tonglen. Very powerful way to develop compassion and loving kindness for ourselves and others. And then the next step is sort of obvious. The next meditation point is called the universal responsibility, the supreme wish, and so on. It's a vow, like I vow to free all beings. I vow to free all beings. I'm personally responsible for freeing all beings from suffering and guiding them to supreme happiness. I'm going to make that leap. I'm going to go from just imagining it to it becoming a truth for me that I vow to do that, excluding no one. This attitude of universal responsibility. And then the final point is the generation of bodhicitta. You know, it's sort of a fallout of everything that's come to this point, is that we, you know, what we want to do is what we just said. I want to remove, be the cause for sentient beings to be free of suffering, and I want to guide them to supreme enlightenment, to the bliss of supreme enlightenment. But I don't have the skills to do it. Therefore, I must train my mind. The goal is to help beings be free of suffering, and have perfect happiness and enlightenment. The goal is to help them do that. And the method is for us to train our mind, to alleviate our faults, and to develop our qualities. So I must become enlightened in order to help others. I must help others. And the method to do that is to train my mind and become enlightened. Train my mind in renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. In ethics, concentration, and wisdom. In all the steps in the path. You know, I must become a Buddha in order to help others. I can do as much as I can now. You know, but my ultimate goal is eliminating my faults and developing my qualities as much as possible. So we've come to the end of this disjointed class. We start, stop so many times, but we did finish it. So thank you for those of you who made the effort to be here. You know, it's always good. You know, I think all of us who teach Discovering Buddhism would. Quickly point out that it's a great way to learn the material, and it's such a so otherwise we wouldn't be, you know, we wouldn't have a chance to learn the material and go in and really make a special effort to learn it better if you didn't show up. So thank you for giving me a chance to train myself. More or less, it's true. So thank you for being here. You know, hopefully, you know, there's been some benefit. I believe there has. I mean, karmic seeds have been planted, and these seeds will ripen in future happiness, there's no doubt. And it, you know, it'll happen when it does, but I think we can be confident of that. So we want to spend just a moment when we read the dedication verses. We want to dedicate the individually, but also collectively, all the merit that we've generated in participating in this class, and the dedication verses.
246.
There it is, from Master Shantideva. Okay. May all beings everywhere plagued by suffering of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creatures suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid of a little with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May our medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and the bound be freed. May the powerless find power. May people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, till then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you. Do you want to say something?
I just want to say thank you, Don. We have a thank you card in the back, but I didn't want anyone to miss their chance to sign it. So we're not sneaky enough to get all the way around during class. So we also have chocolate. It's been a while since we handed out chocolate.
Thank you.
And it's dark chocolate, so maybe
the healthy kind. Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. Good for my heart.
And every once in a while, we got to remember the people that show up every week to open the bookstore. And Chris picked a great day to sub for Brian. Thank you so much for streaming all the claps from the...
Thank you, Aaron, for showing up every week and making Discovering Buddhism happen. Amen. All right. Well, that's it.
Emptiness starts... the class on emptiness starts in a couple weeks. Yeah. And the class starts in a couple weeks, first week of May, first Monday of May.
Yeah.